Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 183, I'm joined by Dr. Pradeep Prasad from Los Angeles to discuss the work he has done in the county hospital system to improve efficiency in patient and physician satisfaction and experience. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also, remember that you can claim CME credits via the AAO website for select episodes. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim your credits. Hey, it's Jay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sounds great. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be joined by Dr. Pradeep Prasad. Dr. Prasad is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he also serves as the chief of the Division of Ophthalmology at Harbor-UCLA Medical Center. Dr. Prasad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's your first time on the program, and all new guests get the same question, which is interesting to not only our younger listeners, but to all of us. So how did you first decide on ophthalmology and then retina? Was this something that you had decided early in med school, before med school, or how did you come to find the field?
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking about ophthalmology at all in medical school. It was actually when I did the ophthalmology rotation that I really fell in love with it. I probably could have been happy with in a number of different fields. Just my personality, I'm just curious about a lot of different topics, and I probably could have been happy doing something different. But I think what really drew me to ophthalmology were the people, the people that I felt like they were very similar to me. They were sort of detail oriented and liked to be experts in a certain field. Also, they were just generally happy people. So I was just drawn to, I think, the individuals that I worked with, and it just sort of grew from there.
You know, you did your training at UCLA and then also your vitreoretinal fellowship at UCLA. And then after that, you stayed on, and now you're serving as the chief of the Division of Ophthalmology at Harbor. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, working as a chief in Harbor is a county, although it's affiliated with UCLA. In the county system. I know that having trained in the county system, and you trained at UCLA with Harbor, and all of you are trained here with Jackson, and people who trained in other big institutes that are affiliated with the county, there's definitely advantages to training in a county, and there's definitely challenges to working or training in a county. What sort of things, you know, have you encountered now working as chief from an administrative standpoint? You know, a lot of residents and fellows listening have worked in those sort of environments. What are kind of the biggest lessons you've learned about working and kind of flourishing in that environment?
Right. Well, when I first took over as a chief, the clinical operations were really, I wouldn't say in disarray, but there was certainly a lot of work to be done. Mm-hmm. With respect to, you know, just delivering patient care in an efficient manner. Patients were waiting for very long periods of time to receive care, whether they were actually in the clinic and waiting for a long period of time or just waiting to get into the clinic or into the operating room. So that was certainly a top priority, is trying to find a solution to that. And also, I think that previously there was certainly a lot of autonomy that our trainees had at the county facility, and there's good and bad with that, right? So the good is, you know, you get a lot of hands-on experience. You learn problem solving sort of on the fly, and it prepares you for being able to handle sort of anything that comes your way once you're done with training. So it gives you a great deal of confidence. But at the same time, I think that has to be balanced with good supervision and teaching, and making sure that sort of bad habits don't continue. And so, and that's true just for an individual, and also bad habits that may be taught from a senior trainee to a junior trainee. So I think that from an education perspective, that was a really important thing to make sure that we had adequate supervision, both in the clinic and in the operating room, and that we had a curriculum in place to make sure that we had certain goals that we wanted our residents and fellows to achieve during their rotation. So to address those issues, we did a lot of work on the clinical operations side of things. What was kind of interesting was that our CEO of Harbor UCLA at the time had come from another facility where he had worked with Toyota, actually implementing their the Toyota production system, the lean methodology in their hospital, and found it to be really effective. And I was working on this project. He was aware that I was working on it, and he had actually reached out to Toyota, which they're one of their big facilities actually just happened to be down the street. And so he reached out to them, thought they might be interested in doing a philanthropic project with us. And they were interested. They actually wanted to choose one area, and they were looking at a number of different clinical areas within the hospital, and they decided to work with us. Which was really fortuitous from our perspective, because they brought all of the resources of Toyota to our clinic. And so they spent hours and hours of time. You know, it was actually a project over the course of about a year, just analyzing our operations, coming up with solutions. And it really made a huge impact. Our wait times were reduced by about 75%.
Oh, wow.
Our new patient encounters increased. I think we tripled our number of new patient encounters that we were able to do per day. So that addressed some of our backlog issues. And that, along with a new operating room that was built at our facility, really helped us to address both our clinical needs and also our surgical backlog. So previously, patients were waiting for 6+ months to have surgery. And because we were able to get a lot more operating room time and new equipment and all the things that come, the efficiencies that come with that, we were able to basically eliminate our backlog. So patients previously, as an example, retina surgery, we take care of a lot of diabetic patients. Patients who were waiting for, you know, as I said, 6 months or more, sometimes for surgery. And as you know, the window to be able to really change the course of somebody's path with these diseases is much shorter than that. So that was a huge benefit to our patients, to be able to intervene early and to be able to, you know, restore their vision, or at least give them a better chance of good vision going forward. It's also, I think, a lot of benefit to us as physicians, trainees, because there's nothing more, I think, frustrating and disconcerting than operating on somebody who you know is not going to have a great outcome, you know, because just the window to intervene has already passed. So I think that that's also boosted morale. We really feel like we're doing great work and we're really helping our community. That's really been a huge change for us.
So let's talk about specifics, because I think that's fascinating. 75% reduction in wait time is something that, you know, everyone from private practice to the quote-unquote least efficient sort of managed care or some county systems would strive for, as wait times become more and more a priority, not only, you said, you know, for patient expectations, but for patient outcomes. Medicine maybe has been slower than other fields to adopt some of these practices that have been used in other industries, like you mentioned the Toyota's model, or even the air industry, for example. What sort of specific, you mentioned a few things about reducing wait times. In terms of your clinic flow, what sort of specific things did you learn from the Toyota model that you instituted that really improved things? Again, within the context that every situation has limitations, it sounds like if you can show results, you can get the funding to do things. But there still is always a cap in terms of how many things you can do. So what were kind of the most important things you felt that improved your clinic flow for the resident and other county ophthalmology clinics?
Right. So I think one thing we had to realize is the constraints of our system, right? So we weren't going to get a huge influx of support staff. We weren't going to get more space. Actually, spaces was one of the biggest issues for us. So knowing that, we had to try to optimize with what we had. And so the first step, and I would encourage this for anybody who's interested in improving their clinical operations or their operational efficiency in general, is to collect data. So we really tried to break down our entire patient experience into bite-sized steps. So that would be the check-in process, the intake process. We happen to, our clinic is in a hospital setting, so the regulatory issues around patient care are slightly different. We have nursing staff who do our intake, and they do a lot of things that may not happen in a typical clinical setting, like smoking assessments and fall risk assessments and things like that. So there's that intake piece. There's the diagnostic testing step. There's the actual provider's time with the patient, the time that's spent discussing the patient's care with an attending, a supervising physician, and then finally the discharge piece. So we really tried to break that down into bite-sized pieces, and that's not true for every patient. There's rework cycles that happen as well. So some patients may come in and a provider decides that they want to get testing done, and so that they get kicked out into the diagnostic testing or diagnostic imaging sort of piece of their patient experience. And so, like I said, not everybody's flow is linear. There's a lot of twists and turns along the way, so to speak. But getting the data to understand what the limitations were at each step was a key piece. So identifying bottlenecks is really critical to being able to improve efficiency. If the bottleneck, for example, is the nursing workup piece, then it doesn't really make sense to try to optimize the physician's efficiency, because it's not really going to result in increased throughput in the clinic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So 95% of the time that was spent actually with Toyota was really just data gathering. Mm-hmm. And that's a topic that that I've become really interested in. In fact, this whole experience made me interested enough in operational efficiency that I ended up getting an MBA through Anderson, through their fully employed program. And this data collection piece is the linchpin of the whole process, because not only is it a starting point to decide what you're going to do, what steps you're going to take, but after you've made your changes, you have to have some metrics to know whether or not what you've done has actually made a difference. And that's where this idea of continuous improvement comes from, is that you don't just make one change or a handful of changes, then you're done. It's, once you address one bottleneck, a new bottleneck arises, and you
Right.
keep going through your entire system to continuously improve upon the system. So that's the hardest part, and not everybody has the resources to do that. I mean, we certainly didn't have the resources to collect the data in enough granularity that we could actually make decisions or better understand our process. So that's something where you may have to rely on maybe one or two of your staff members to not partake in patient care for a bit so that they can collect data. That's not feasible for everybody, and we certainly needed Toyota's help in order to do that. But once we did that, we were able to then make changes. And at each step, we started making changes, and we started seeing results. And there's just really simple things that we changed. So as an example, we've noticed that our providers were spending a lot of time just looking for supplies. They just didn't have the things that they needed to take care of patients at their immediate disposal. And so we moved all of those supplies into the room. It sounds like such a simple thing, but the process actually illuminated, I think, our entire team to the fact that we have to make the providers' jobs as efficient and as easy as possible. So that was one change that we made. Another was that we noticed that a lot of patients were moving in and out of the clinic. Because of the size constraints, we would have patients who we have a large waiting room, would have patients come in, they would get one thing done, whether that be the nursing workup or the testing or whatever it may be, and then they would move back out into the waiting room, and there's this constant back and forth movement. And that's very inefficient. It's frustrating from a patient's perspective to have to go in and out of a clinic. And it also just the movement of everybody creates a very sort of chaotic workspace. And so we changed our clinic layout a little bit, and our messaging system a little bit, so that we only bring patients into the clinic once there's a capacity for them to be able to complete their entire process. We don't have them go in and out. And so we devised a very low-tech but effective system to message between nursing staff, technicians, and providers as far as what step of the process the patients were in, what tests they needed to be done to streamline that whole process. So that was another change that we made. We implemented a morning huddle, sort of a daily check with all members of our team, so that we could talk about issues that were arising and just be all on the same page as far as how we should address, for example, inpatients coming to the clinic for same day consultations. How can we make that process as streamlined as possible, so it doesn't impact our regularly scheduled clinic patients? Little things like that that we talk about on a daily basis that help us to all be on the same page and B, to problem solve. There are short-term solutions that we can identify, and then there's also long-term issues or long-term projects that we identify. And so we actually have a board in our clinic that identifies what our goals are, what metrics we're monitoring, projects that are ongoing that staff members or providers are working on to find solutions for. And so getting all of that organized is another, I think, piece of the puzzle as well.
You know, I think it's fascinating, like you said, the whole process, the reevaluation, and then the idea of bottlenecks. I think that any of us who have worked in the county system with trainees, ophthalmology residents, fellows, it's never really the physicians that are the bottleneck. But one thing that's theoretically possible, and maybe you haven't arrived at this point, is you start getting rid of so many of the bottlenecks that eventually you look and the bottleneck is at the physician side, because trainees just may not be as efficient as attending physicians in that same circumstance, even with supervision. And so my question for you, whether you've encountered it or eventually you encounter it, what's your kind of philosophy on that point? When you reach the point where now you're balancing efficiency versus educating the next generation of ophthalmologists, how do you balance that to continue to maintain those same standards and avoid a huge bottleneck while still allowing for these physicians to grow and learn in the same way that you or I did in our systems?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And actually, what's interesting is that changes as the academic year progresses, right? So at the beginning of the year, when our new residents are just learning how to do an exam, versus later in the academic year where they're cruising and they've got a lot of experience and certainly a lot more knowledge under their belts, it changes. And a year may seem like a long time, but actually it doesn't. It flies by. And so being able to change as time goes by is really critical. So this is a really important topic, and something that I think this idea of service to education ratio is a very big topic in our department. We actually try to we downbook our clinics heavily at the beginning of the year, and then we slowly increase the volume as the year goes by, so that we can give our providers more time early on in the academic year. I think also having attendings available to pitch in. They're not, our attendings aren't just there to supervise, but if need be, they're involved in direct patient care to help with the clinic flow. That's also really important, getting buy-in from providers to be able to be willing to do that is really important. I think that patient volume is really critical to allowing our trainees to have enough time to think about patients, to learn, to discuss patients with the attendings. You have to have sort of backup measures in place, and that's where having the attendings who can step in and help with patient volume is an important thing. We also try to carve out time, outside of our busy clinic schedule to discuss patients. So one of the things that I do is I actually review almost all of the notes that are written in our clinic and identify interesting teachable cases. And the teaching varies. Sometimes it has to do with documentation, how the documentation could have been more effective. Sometimes it's just related to the actual patient care and the pathology. Other times it may have to do with sort of a systems-based approach. How could we have integrated this patient's care with the other subspecialty providers a little bit better? So there's different, there's lots of different things that one can talk about. But what we, what I do is I try to pull those sort of teachable cases to the side. And then in the more, either in the morning or at lunchtime, what we do is we as a team, we sit down and we talk about things, and actually the dialogue that happens is really quite the most educational, one of the highest yield educational experiences for our trainees, because it gives them an opportunity to ask questions in a low stress situation where they're not pressured to see the next patient. We can just take our time and discuss all of the different issues around a patient's care, and the residents can talk to each other about what they've done or how they've experienced certain issues and how they've approached it, and the learning doesn't just have, it's not just the attending teaching the trainees. I learn a lot from my trainees, and I learn more about some of the logistical hurdles that they encounter, and it gives me some information about projects that I can work on to help make their lives easier. So it's, I think, pulling that some of that educational piece outside of a busy clinic is really helpful. Of course, teaching in the moment is also extremely valuable, but you have to, you know, set aside a little bit of quiet time, either, you know, again, before, during, you know, in the middle, during lunch, or after clinic to discuss patients.
Dr. Prasad, I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, I can understand, you know, our colleague, my friend, Dr. Ali Khan, had recommended I talk to you. I can see this is a topic near and dear to his heart as well. And you guys have really created an excellent model. I mean, importing, again, ideas from the business world into in a setting that, and historically, people have kind of just shrugged their shoulders and put their hands up and said, this is just the way it is, and it's the way it's always been, and kind of finding that balance between understanding that there are limitations and then still making things better. It's been really, really impressive, and I think we all could definitely learn a lot from the experience and what you guys have done at Harbor. So thanks again for sharing with our listeners, and thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 183 episodes. Yes, 183 episodes, including this one. You can find them all there, sort of by category. You also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member, visit the link in the episode description. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom of our links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Android Store. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store or Android Store directly. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the contest link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Pradeep Prasad for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venenkasa for producing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.